Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Zach Wolf from the Zach Wolf Law Firm in Houston. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thank you, Todd. Thanks, Jody. Good to be here.
Well, a lot of folks who listen to our show, if they're on appellate Twitter with us, which a lot of our listeners are, certainly know who you are and have some idea what you're about. But for those who don't, let's talk a little about your background, kind of where you come from, and maybe your early career.
Sure. Happy to do that. Now, the first thing I have to address is the elephant in the room, which is this kind of looks like a mantle here. You know, we don't have a lot of diversity, so I may get in a little trouble. Lady Lawyer Diaries may get on me. But in my defense, I saw it said Jody Sanders on the thing, and I thought, okay, we're good.
You're not the first person that's made that mistake.
So don't blame me. But anyway, it's great to be here. Oh, yeah. So I'll try to be brief about me. I have practiced business litigation in Texas for almost 25 years in several places. I first met Todd when I was practicing in Austin. I'm now based in Houston, but I practice all over the state. And I've had a solo law practice now for about 6 months. I still do business litigation, but my focus is really on non-compete and trade secret litigation, or sometimes I call it departing employee litigation. People don't always know what that means, but cases involving employees usually leaving a company and going to work for a competitor. And I represent all sides of that equation, just depending on who hires me. And that's probably about 90% of my practice now. In addition to that, so a lot of you know, I have a blog called 5 Minute Law. If you don't know, please go check it out, 5minutelaw.com. I also have a YouTube channel. It's called That Non-Compete Lawyer, and it has lots of non-compete material. The YouTube channel is a little more geared towards non-lawyers, but I think lawyers can find interesting stuff there too. I do not have a podcast, though.
Yet.
I'm a little behind y'all.
Yeah,
not yet. I've thought about it, but not yet. But anyway, thanks. I'm excited to be on the Texas Appellate. Is it a Texas Appellate Law podcast?
It is.
Texas Appellate Law. But we'll answer to anything, you know.
That's right.
You know, that's true. I knew you had started up a YouTube channel, but I mentioned appellate Twitter. I mean, you're very active on Twitter and in that form of social media specifically. And I certainly admired what you've done with your blog and now the YouTube channel and have sort of linking all that together to really be, a great resource for folks who have the kinds of problems that you work on. You're doing a stupendous job putting yourself out there with that. And you were doing it long before you went out on your own. I mean, you were doing it when you were part of your previous firm. And I have to think that that really helped you, you know, certainly with some name recognition as you started your own practice. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is actually my second time to practice solo. And the first time was not successful. And this time appears to be successful so far. And I can kind of contrast the two to see what is making the second one successful. And when I say unsuccessful, I mean, the first time I brought in enough money to pay the bills. So, I mean, it was successful in that sense, but I didn't have enough client work to really sustain a solo practice. So I ended up going back to a firm I had worked for previously. This time, I think one of the differences is that I have, over the last 5 years, really made a concerted effort to put out a lot of content and to get my name out there. But not just that, I found the big difference for me has been the specialization. The blog covers a lot of topics. It's not just focused on one practice area, but there is definitely kind of a focus on what I do, which is the non-compete and trade secret stuff. And so that's really what has made the difference, is letting people know what I do and having a specialized practice area, as opposed to just litigation, which is what I was doing the first time I tried solo practice. And back then, I mean, I got some great advice from my dad, who is not a lawyer, but had a successful small business that he started up. And he basically said, keep your overhead low and do a lot of networking. And that was great advice. And I did those things. I did a lot of networking, but I think what was missing was that specialty, so that people I networked with would not just think Zach's a lawyer, but they think Zach's a specific kind of lawyer.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes, receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Has the area of like non-compete, trade secret, has that been an area that's kind of grown in the last few years? Is it one of those areas that's grown, or are you just kind of tapping into a market that was always there?
It's always been there, but I do get the sense, just anecdotally, that it has grown. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually wrote a blog post about non-compete cases like starting in the 1920s. So that kind of case has been around for a long time. But I think things have changed in the sense that now, almost every time some valuable employee leaves a company and goes to a competitor, there's the potential for a lawsuit, even if they don't have a non-compete. For one thing, now, almost all the time they do have a non-compete, it has become almost routine, even for lower level salespeople. And then even if they don't have a non-compete, you can always make the trade secrets argument. You can always say, well, he's got our customer list and he knows our prices and those are trade secrets. And so this salesperson is going to a competitor and we have to stop that. And I do get the sense that there's more and more of that. It was funny because somebody asked me, I was talking to another lawyer about what I do, and he said, and he was kind of surprised that there was enough of that, that I could just do that. And I was like, dude, if I just got 1% of that, I would be set. You know, I mean, there's so many of those lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you gravitate to that kind of work? I mean, it is certainly an interesting area. We've got some sort of appellate overlay topics to talk about with respect to that. But, you know, you take the broader area of, say, commercial litigation, and you start winnowing down, you know, what to specialize in. So how did you pick trade secrets and non-competes specifically?
That's a great question. And it reminds me of a guest blog post that a lawyer named Maria Granofsky did for me. And she came up with this great phrase. It was like, are you tripping over gold bars while looking for copper deposits? But what she meant by that was, are you looking for a specific kind of legal work and ignoring the legal work that's right there at your feet that you already have? And that definitely applied to what I did. The reason I chose to start writing about non-compete law was that that's the kind of work I was getting. Mm-hmm. You know, my first big litigation matter when I first went solo was a non-compete and trade secret lawsuit. That's what I was working on. So I thought, hey, why not write about that and try to get more of that work? So it wasn't like I just one day looked around at all the practice areas and said, oh, this one looks like the best. It's just what I had. And I think you can apply that to any practice area. So, for example, if you're an appellate lawyer, I mean, let's say you're getting a bunch of appeals. Oh, I don't know, maybe regarding a statute called the TCPA. You know, maybe that becomes your specialty, that you do TCPA appeals. Now that's TCPA. Now it's not as fun as it used to be. But for a while it was really hot. So, but that's just one example. Mm-hmm. So think about what kind of work are you getting, or what kind of work are you likely to get in the situation you're in? And now keep in mind, I don't want to say it's one size fits all, that that's what everybody has to do. So if you've got a certain practice area in mind and you don't have any of that work, but you just know that's what you want to do, that's okay. I mean, you can try that. But I think for most people, the better approach is to think about, what kind of work am I already exposed to? Because then it's just a natural fit. Mm-hmm. And then also, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? I mean, people ask me, how do you have the time to do all these blog posts? You know, well, I mean, one is it does take time, and I usually write them on the weekend. And so it does take some time, but I'm getting my material out of my practice most of the time. You know, I'm not just finding some new topic just from scratch most of the time. Occasionally there might be something in the news and I think, okay, I'm going to go check that out and find out about that. But most of the time it's just coming out of work I've already done for clients.
Yeah.
I would think of your practice, particularly the non-compete trade secret stuff, as one of the ones where you probably spend a lot more time in court than your average civil lawyer, because there's so much, you know, TRO injunction practice hot and heavy at the very beginning.
Yes, that is definitely true. I mean, in my practice, I guess if you want to be in the courtroom, it's sort of good news, bad news. My cases hardly ever go to trial. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably true of business litigation generally, but especially for my practice area. I mean, I had a jury trial in a non-compete case a few years ago, but they very rarely get to a jury trial. And that's mainly because usually the injunction hearing is the key event. So
that's the trial de facto, right?
Yeah, in a sense, that becomes the trial. And so I guess the good news in my practice area is that you do get a lot of opportunities to be in the courtroom, whether it's on a TRO or on a temporary or preliminary injunction hearing. The TROs are always fun because there's no rules whatsoever.
It's the Wild West. Yeah. You know,
for better or for worse. Yeah. Wild West for sure. Injunction hearings, more like a trial, although even there, you know, the judge has a lot of discretion in terms of how to conduct that. I just had one recently where I ended up going down there three times. And the judge, we had one day where we ran out of time. And so he just reset it for, you know, to continue a week later, you know, which you typically don't have most of the time in a jury trial. So with the temporary injunctions, yeah, there's still a lot of variety, but yeah, if you want to get in the courtroom, that's usually your chance to do it.
I'm a little surprised to hear you say you don't have a lot of appeal stuff going on, because, you know, we appellate lawyers kind of foam at the mouth because the temporary injunctions are one of the better known interlocutory appeals that are available by statute. And as many TI hearings as you handle, you know, I would think that given the outcome of that, I guess one answer to that question, though, could be that the cases get resolved at the TI stage rather than appeal. Is that right?
That's right. I do get some appeals. I've got two appeals on temporary injunctions going right now. I've got one where I was on the defense side and we were successful and the injunction was denied and the plaintiff has appealed. I've got another one where I was defending, injunction was granted, I'm appealing. Those are both interlocutory appeals. So yeah, we do get those, but you put your finger on it. Most of the cases get resolved even before that point. And I would say the more experience I've gained in this practice area, in a sense, the more likely it is I'm going to resolve something by agreement. You know, like on a temporary injunction, a lot of times I can just say, okay, you know, my client will agree to return these documents or not use this information or not do business with this list of customers or, you know, something like that. So even before the injunction hearing, a lot of times these cases can get resolved.
You mentioned that you are working both sides of it, which I find interesting, you know, the employer and the employee side. I guess I've seen some folks who really focus on one or the other, and largely on the employer side. As you have cases from the employees, though, you know, we all, or as lawyers, we all like to get paid, right? So I'm wondering, you know, are you most often retained by the employee, or does the employer sometimes come in and help foot the bill?
It's both. And I think the thing to keep in mind for this kind of work is that usually there are two employers, mm-hmm. right? So you might get hired by the employer who's suing to stop the former employee, or you might get hired by the second company that hired the employee. And I do both of those things. In terms of how much of my practice, I do get contacted by a lot of individual employees, and that could be anybody from a salesperson up to a high level executive and everything in between. A lot of times those people will find me just directly, whether they saw my YouTube video or blog post or whatever, or they were referred to me by a lawyer who knows that's what I do. But I also get hired by companies. Typically, the kind of companies that hire me as a solo are companies where the owner is making the decision, and the owner or owners of the company are contacting me. So I don't do a lot where I'm representing a really big company with an in-house legal department. Typically, those companies are not hiring a whole lot of solos. Mm-hmm. Usually, they're going to have relationships yeah. with bigger firms already. So I don't get much of that, but that's okay. There's plenty of work from the mm-hmm. from small to mid-sized companies.
Do you do much in the way of the transactional side of things, kind of consulting business owners or employees when they're negotiating how to draft their non-competes or how to draft their trade secret policies, that type of stuff?
Yes, definitely. I do a lot of that. It could be drafting a non-compete agreement for an employer client. It could be reviewing one for an employee client. I do it on the front end when employees are starting. I also do a lot with severance situations mm-hmm. where somebody's leaving. You know, the smart employees will call me up to consult with me before they make a decision and before they do anything to get some advice. You know, how enforceable is my agreement? What can I do? What should I not do? That's always great when people do that. That's the smart thing. On the other hand, I also, you know, I come into situations where everything has gone wrong.
Sure.
You know, and I'm mm-hmm. trying to clean up a mess.
That's kind of how we talk on this podcast about appellate lawyers at trial. You know, if you can bring us mm-hmm. in before the trial starts, it's always better than when we show up after the verdict and just kind of have to do what we can do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Jody first introduced me to the colorful label of an appellate prevention practice. And it seems like what you're talking about, Zach, can be largely that lawsuit prevention or litigation prevention by counseling people on the front end, which is, you know, a very wise use of money and resources for the people who have the foresight to utilize that.
Yeah. And I think if you have a small practice like mine with clients who have limited budgets, sometimes the idea of hiring an appellate lawyer seems daunting, but I would recommend to people, you know, maybe at least think about bringing in an appellate lawyer at the jury charge stage. I mean, that's probably one stage where they can provide a lot of value. Maybe even at summary judgment, too. That's probably a good place to have an appellate lawyer look at either your motion or your response. So you don't necessarily need the appellate lawyer, you know, looking at everything you do, but those two stages sure. seem to me like places where appellate lawyers can add a lot of value.
Well, this is kind of a good segue. You know, there are a number of issues where your practice and ours sort of intersect. You mentioned jury charges specifically, and, you know, we have a relatively new trade secret statute in our state that I know has gone through some development. Actually, the pattern jury charges themselves have gone through some development of proposed questions and definitions and instructions. But that seems to be kind of the natural intersection between your practice and ours, because you see, in addition to the temporary injunction issue and, of course, you know, final judgments, you know, it's super important to charge the jury correctly. And what was it like before you had the benefit of the PJCs? And I know you've got some opinions on the PJCs, and I want to explore those. But what was it like before you had the benefit of the PJCs to try to come up with a jury charge on a trade secrets case or a covenant not to compete case?
It was fun. I mentioned a jury trial I had a few years ago. We did have this issue. We had a charge conference. We had a trade secrets question. And I was lucky in that I was proposing a charge that was tailored to the facts of the case. And the other lawyer was proposing one that was more generic. And I was successful in getting mine submitted. And I think that's maybe the biggest overall lesson for appellate lawyers and trial lawyers when you're talking about the jury charge and trade secrets case is, sure, you can use the pattern jury charge, and that's probably a good starting point. But think about, what is the plaintiff's theory of the case in your case? And if there are parts of that pattern charge that don't apply to that, you don't need all that in the charge. So for example, if the issue is, and I'll use that case as an example. In that case, I accomplished something which is rare to accomplish. I got the plaintiff to actually identify what the trade secrets were. And that, they pretty much identified a stack of paper that my clients had taken. Okay. And they said, those are the trade secrets. So I had the jury charge say, you know, did defendants use X to compete with plaintiff? Something like that. All right. Because that's what their theory was. Now, that's not the only kind of misappropriation of trade secrets. You could have other theories, other ways that they violated the trade secrets statute. But if that's their theory, that's what ought to go to the jury. And it makes it a lot more understandable for the jury when you do it like that. I'll throw in one other tip that I think is especially, hopefully, helpful for appellate lawyers. Even now, you'll see appellate opinions that cite common law cases on trade secrets in Texas, even though we have the statute. And I think that's a mistake. Now, maybe it's not a huge mistake because it's not like the common law standard is totally in opposition to the statute. I mean, they're pretty similar, but still, you shouldn't be citing to old cases that define, hey, this is what a trade secret is, when the statute has a definition of what a trade secret is. I won't name any names. I think I've seen the Fifth Circuit do this. You know, and again, it's not that big a deal, but for appellate lawyers who like to be very precise, I think that's an important issue to watch out for.
Is the trade secret statute a uniform statute or is it Texas specific? I can't remember.
It is a uniform statute. I think 47 or 48 states have it. The Texas version has some minor variations, but for the most part, it's uniform. And it's also, for the most part, the same as the federal trade secret statute that is also fairly new. And there again, there are some differences in language, but overall very similar.
That's good advice generally when approaching a charge is if you've got a statute on point, start with that. Mm-hmm. And I'll refer back again. We've talked about the PJCs pretty recently here on the show, and they can be a very useful tool as a starting point for your research and your outlining of a case. And the nice thing about it is, as long as you're referring to the most recent version of them, if there's a statute out there on point, it's going to incorporate the statute and the statutory elements. But that does seem like a pretty big oversight for a court or a practitioner to really rely on the common law, or at least cases predating the statute. Because, yeah, that definition, you know, common law definition doesn't really seem to be all that relevant if there's a statutory definition out there that you've got to be working from.
Right. And the new Texas PJC trade secrets questions do track the statute very closely, which is good. They should, but they may not always be appropriate for your situation. I'll give you another example for appellate lawyers that applies to my kind of case, and that is breach of fiduciary duty. Mm-hmm. Watch out for that, because the pattern jury charge question and instruction on breach of fiduciary duty is one of the most plaintiff-friendly definitions you're ever going to find, right? Once you establish somebody was a fiduciary, then they've got a duty to put the other person's interests first, full disclosure. I mean, it's a great instruction for the plaintiff. In an employer-employee dispute, it does not apply. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of fiduciary duty that the employee has. Nobody thinks that an employee has the kind of fiduciary duty that like a lawyer has to a client.
Right.
Or that a trustee has, right? It's a narrower, they call it a fiduciary duty. That's maybe a poor choice of words, but they call it that, but that's not really what it is. So the plaintiff is going to say, well, here's the instructions straight out of the PJC. I mean, it's fiduciary duty, right? And they're going to want that instruction. But if you're on the defense side, watch out and say, no. We've got to make this narrower because this is just an employee, not, you know, not a traditional.
Yeah. The same is true in partnership cases. You know, those duties are not, they're not fully parallel to the ones that are charged in the PJC. So that, I think that's a great tip across the board. In fiduciary duty cases, check the duties and make sure they actually line up because it may not be totally appropriate.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. In a partnership case, it may be a more limited scope of duty and it might be limited by the partnership agreement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's definitely something to watch out for in the charge. I'll mention one other big charge issue, and that is reasonableness of a non-compete. And this is kind of, this is the advanced portion of the talk today.
Hey, bring it on.
This is something that a lot of lawyers don't think about. A little background. You can find dozens of Texas cases that say the enforceability of a non-compete is a question of law. But you have to take that with a big grain of salt, okay? Because if there's a dispute over the reasonableness of the scope of the non-compete, which there usually is, usually there are going to be fact issues on that. So just for example, let's say there's a dispute about what a salesperson's territory was. That would go to the reasonableness of the scope of the geographic restriction. And you can't answer that without resolving that fact issue. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue that, in my view, needs to go to the jury. But you hardly ever see that. You very rarely see enforceability of the non-compete being submitted to the jury. And I think part of that is it just probably judges are like, no, enforce it. That's for me to decide. That doesn't go to the jury. But I think in many situations, if there's a factual dispute that goes to the reasonableness, that does need to go to the jury. There's no PJC question for that. You're going to have to come up with your own. But there's tons of Texas case law on that. So you should be able to find some language from the case law to give an instruction on to the jury, for example, on what is a reasonable geographic area? Well, then just take some language straight out of the case law and put it in an instruction. And I think that would work.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
All this discussion of jury charge issues, I think, brings me back to your point earlier about specialization and why sometimes that's so important because, you know, your average lawyer off the street who maybe has never done a non-compete or a trade secret case may go back to the common law on some of this stuff. And that's how it ends up in the appellate opinions. When you have someone who's more of a subject matter expert, number one, you're saving a lot of efficiency and time on some of this stuff. But number two, you may just end up with a better presented case to make your record on if you have to go up on appeal.
Yeah, I think that's right. Absolutely. I mean, I've said before, my practice area isn't really that hard. I mean, to be honest, maybe I shouldn't say that. I mean, any good business litigator can figure out my practice area. It's not that difficult. But Jody, like to your point, there are some nuances. And knowing those nuances, having gone through it a dozen times before, there's definitely some value in that.
No, 100% agree.
I'll mention one other place where maybe appellate lawyers can be helpful in the type of lawsuit I typically handle. You've already touched on it, the temporary injunction or preliminary injunction stage. The issue there where I think trial lawyers often go wrong and maybe set themselves up for an appeal is irreparable injury. It's easy to kind of either forget or just not put enough emphasis on the irreparable injury element for getting an injunction. But if you don't have some evidence to establish irreparable injury and you're the plaintiff, you may get that injunction, but you may be setting yourself up for an appeal where the court of appeals is like, where's the evidence of irreparable mm-hmm. injury? Mm-hmm. And not only the evidence, it needs to be stated in the injunction specifically. At least I know under the Texas rule, it needs to say why there would be irreparable injury, and not just in a conclusory way. I just saw a recent case where I think an injunction got reversed because, you know, it had a recital that there was irreparable injury, but it didn't really say why. Mm-hmm. The court said that's not going to cut it. So if you're an appellate lawyer involved at the injunction stage, you know, that's the kind of issue where you could maybe be helpful, because the trial lawyers are usually all focused on, let's show this scheme and how sneaky these guys were and all these terrible things they did, and let's get the judge mad. And, you know, that's kind of how us trial lawyers think. We're not always thinking about, well, what's the evidence we got to have, you know, to support the elements of this injunction. So appellate lawyers can point that out. And then the big value in that is then that tells a trial lawyer what evidence they need to make sure they get in to cover that up.
Oh, come on, Zach. I mean, the trial lawyer, the conversation goes like this. I got the TI. Mr. Appellate Lawyer, it's your job to hold on to it.
Yep, keep it.
But no, I mean, that's completely tongue-in-cheek, of course. I agree with what you said. And I think if I remember right, too, there are some specific rules about irreparable injury with respect to things like real estate that are even a little different than just, because some of it's statutory, I think. And you just really, that's another area where temporary injunctions, there's a few landmines there to watch out for if you're not really familiar with trying to go and get that kind of relief.
Yeah, it reminds me of that phrase. I heard somebody say, I didn't come up with this, but it was trial lawyers drive for show, appellate lawyers putt for dough.
I'm going to put that on the back of my business card.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's holding on. It's one thing to make a big show and get a big verdict, but holding on to it is sometimes the hard part.
Well, let's preach that to your trial lawyer brethren, as we like to do here occasionally on our show. Well, those are all great points, super relevant to our particular interests. And
I'm just curious. Let me ask y'all.
Sure.
We've been talking injunctions. From your perspective, what do you see either maybe people not doing right or not paying enough attention to? Anything that us trial lawyers need to be thinking about?
To me, one of the things that I have seen the most over the years is the wording of the actual injunction order. And it's so easy to your point, to just sort of gloss over and say, oh, there's irreparable injury. Oh, you know, there's harm. But if you don't say what it is, or you don't, get the rule out, read the rule when you're drafting it, and follow every step, because it is really easy for someone to get an injunction voided simply because you just missed a step in there. You know, I mean, something as simple as truly just forgetting to set it for trial. You know, I mean, that is an easy thing to just overlook because it's not in the back of your mind, because you're thinking, what have I proven? And then you just forget to set it for trial. Well, it's too bad. That means the appellate court's going to kick it out. And it's just a little thing that can be done. So I think that's probably the big one that I've seen, is just make sure that you follow the rules to a T, because an appellate court, you know, all you need is for a staff attorney to go through their checklist and go, oh, didn't do that. Okay, well, this is an easy case.
Right.
And then you've spent all that time and effort only to have it go away for that kind of reason.
Yeah,
right. If you're appealing an injunction, you're more likely to win on that kind of issue 100%. Than on some issue about, oh, well, the evidence wasn't really strong enough. You know, that's with the abuse of discretion standard. You're usually not going to win on those factual arguments, but got something technical like that where they just messed up, that you're going to have something there.
Yeah, because once you're into competing proof in that kind of situation, I mean, it's so much harder to get past it, because the trial judge does have a tremendous amount of discretion to kind of figure out the credibility of the witnesses, look at the proof, all that kind of stuff. And they don't want to wade into that unless it's just something that's glaringly obvious, or some kind of, you know, just omission of proof. You know, you really didn't prove irreparable injury, or you didn't really prove that they took anything.
Let me ask you this. Speaking of glaringly obvious, I'm getting some free advice here. Let's say, let's say just hypothetically, I got an executive from the plaintiff company to admit there was no imminent threat of any of the customers leaving. And yet my client was enjoined from contacting those customers. I would think, I'm just an unsophisticated trial lawyer, but I think that would be pretty good ground for appeal.
I don't know. I guess it would depend on how the evidence came in, but I take your point. If you have one side kind of conceding that this really doesn't exist and it's not really a harm, I mean, that seems like a pretty powerful weapon to take up on appeal.
It does seem like an omission, you know, something lacking in the need for the injunction. I'd have to agree with that.
Yeah, so back fairness, in my hypothetical, let's assume there was some, that wasn't the only evidence. But
okay,
that's where it starts to get tricky. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
But still, I think it's a powerful point.
Coming back to your question about what do we see, I agree with Jody. You know, get out Rule 683 and make sure you follow it to a T. I think some things that people don't necessarily think about are the what happens after the TI. Like, you know, you got to have usually a bond, and do you have an arrangement set to get your bond in place? I've litigated cases where the amount of the bond was significant. And, you know, people need to keep in mind, okay, what happens to that bond if the TI is overturned? If you've got a case like I had one where the bond was $1 million. So you're talking about a really significant amount of money that, depending on the outcome of the injunction, could wind up being lost. And so getting the bond in place is one thing. The other, I think, is service of the injunction. I think people tend to overlook, this is not like serving notice of deposition. It's got to be served a different way. And you've got to make sure, because there are due process issues that underlie TIs. And so that's another, I think, big concern that folks don't always think about. You're more concerned with, oh, we got the injunction. All right. Well, what's next? You got to think about these other things too.
Yeah, I think the bond and service are big things to make sure you think about for sure. On the bond, I've learned to warn the client about that ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things we just kind of assume there's going to be a bond, but a client doesn't necessarily know that's coming.
Mm-hmm.
So you might get the injunction granted, and then you're like, oh, you got to write a check now. And the client's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So I've started trying to let people know ahead of time that's going to happen.
And make friends with the clerks because, you know, depending on what county you're in, sometimes maybe they have not done $1 million TI bond and you kind of have to help them through the process as much as they help you. So make friends with them and kind of discuss how it needs to be done and check all those boxes, because that really can expedite all that stuff so much. And that's not necessarily unique to non-competes, but just in general, that kind of stuff really does make a difference. The little nuts and bolts things that you forget about.
Absolutely.
So true.
Yeah. Be nice to the clerks is good advice all the time. And it's advice you'd think maybe wouldn't be necessary. And
yet, yeah,
it is.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground on your practice area, but I know that there's another area of interest to you that I'm interested in too, which is the disciplinary rules, the Texas disciplinary rules. We had Shauna Willing on recently to talk about disciplinary system. So this sort of segues into that. But we've had some key changes that you've, I know, written some blog posts, maybe even spoken about a little. And with some of these are sort of relevant to you specifically, because having left your former firm and now gone into solo practice, you know, you're thinking about things like, oh, what am I going to name my law firm? And how am I going to advertise, if at all? And that sort of thing. So tell us about how you developed an interest in that particular subject matter.
Yeah, so it really started under the previous version of the Texas advertising rules. And I've always been interested in doing CLE speaking, and I started doing a lot of that. And of course, people are always looking for ethics credit. So I thought it would be good to have something in the ethics arena where I could develop some expertise. So I did that with the advertising rules, and I've spoken on them multiple times and written about them. And then in the course of that, the rules got updated which was a good thing, because part of what I used to speak about was how the old rules were poorly written and hard to apply. The committee that rewrote the advertising rules did a good job. They're much improved. They're less burdensome, I think, and also more clear. And the committee was very gracious. I submitted a memo as part of the public comment process, and they actually took my memo into account and made some further changes. So the overall news is good. These new advertising rules are an improvement. And if you want to, if you're really into this topic and you're an ethics nerd, I've got a blog post called The Top 15 Changes to These Advertising Rules. You can go check that out. For today, I've got just a handful that I thought I would hit that are probably of interest to appellate lawyers, if you want to talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, so Todd mentioned the name of your firm, and that gets to the change that is probably, that has probably gotten the most attention, at least in the press, and that's allowing trade names. So now, you know, if you want to call your firm Austin Appellate Lawyers, and then in theory, you could do that as a trade name. You could be Austin Appellate Lawyers PLLC or whatever it is. Previously, you couldn't do that. Now, I don't think it's that big of a change, really, because you could always use some name like that as a trademark. You just couldn't actually have if your firm be called that, right? So that's really the main difference. And then I don't know if the trade name thing is that big a deal for appellate lawyers, because it's not the kind of practice area where you're going to see, you know, Texas Sledgehammer Appellate Lawyers on a billboard or something, right? I mean, so
yeah.
I expect appellate lawyers are probably going to continue with the more traditional, you know, names of the partners and that sort of thing. But in theory, if you wanted to have an appellate boutique and have something about appeals in the actual name of your firm, you could do that now. So that was a big change. Another change that I think is important for all Texas lawyers, and including appellate lawyers, to know about is that now that there is a specific definition of advertising in the rules. Now, why does that matter? The main reason it matters is because the rules have a filing requirement for advertising. So when you put out advertising in the public media, you're supposed to file that with the State Bar Advertising Review Committee. And that can be kind of an onerous requirement. That becomes especially relevant when we talk about social media, right? Because you don't want to have to file something every time you post on LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is, Instagram. So the definition, here's what you need to keep in mind. The key part of the definition of advertising is that it's an advertisement if it offers or promotes legal services. So that's really the key. You need to think about, am I explicitly offering or promoting legal services? In marketing circles, they usually call this the call to action.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about, like, if at the end of the podcast, you know, the two of you say, hey, if you have an appeal and you need help with it, call Todd Smith or Jody Sanders. That would be the call to action. That would be advertising.
To be clear, we're not doing that, State Bar.
Yeah, right.
So if you're listening.
Yes.
Yeah,
these are Zach Wolf's words only, yeah. Not ours.
That is not what they're doing. Because, yeah, that would be advertising. And then you would have to file that. So that's the main point to keep in mind, especially when you're putting stuff on social media. So, you know, don't say, call me if you need help with a similar kind of case. You know, just if you're posting something, let's say you're posting something about a recent court decision, you know, just put the information about the court decision. And the thing is, I mean, people will know that they can contact you about that kind of case.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's implied. So you don't really need to say that. The other thing that changed in the advertising rules is an exemption for information that is primarily educational or informational. Now, I'm not going to say that I was responsible for getting this exemption in the rules, but I'm not saying it either.
You're not responsible.
Right, right. So this one is near and dear to my heart. And previously, there was an informal interpretive comment from the State Bar that essentially said the same thing. And that was helpful. But now the exemption is actually right there in the rules. And that's really helpful because that's what covers most of the kind of stuff that we do. That's what this podcast is. This podcast is primarily educational or informational. That's why this podcast is not an advertisement, right? Because we're here sharing information and educating people who are listening, I hope. But yeah, that's the key exemption. And so when you're on social media, whether you're an appellate lawyer or another kind of lawyer, that's the key thing to keep in mind. Keep your content. The full definition here, it says primarily informational, educational, political, or artistic in nature, or made for entertainment purposes. So if you fall into one of those things, then, and you're not explicitly offering or promoting legal services, then you're probably not advertising and you're okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of buildup in history to this change. I mean, but one thing that people need to keep in mind is that these rules are difficult to change. There's a big process, and we've had rules initiatives in the past that have not gone through. And so the committee that put together these changes, it was a very long process. It required a lot of public comment. And I know, Zach, you were part of that. And it kind of stems back to, you know, think about how much our communications have evolved over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, nobody knew what Twitter was 15 years ago. And people, lawyers started using it with basically no guidelines other than what the rules that were written that didn't even capture email communications until I think about 2005 or six, which is kind of nutty if you think about it. So this was a really welcome change because now lawyers can look at these rules and have specific guidance on what to do and what not to do. The Advertising Review Committee was, I think, really good about working with lawyers about specific communications. And Gene Major, who heads up that part of the State Bar agency, was great about going out and giving CLE talks about what was okay, what wasn't. But now we've got a lot of clarity, I think, and a lot more certainty in what we can and can't do. And so that's certainly a big benefit.
Yeah, and I'll mention one more change that's a positive one and probably impacts a lot of appellate lawyers. And that's the change about calling yourself a specialist or saying that you specialize. Under the previous rules, if you were not board certified, you could not say that you specialize or call yourself a specialist in general. Now, you could sort of get around that by just using a different word, like I focus my practice on appeals. That was okay. But now that has been changed and you can say you specialize. You don't necessarily have to be board certified in appellate law to do that. It's still cannot be false or misleading. So obviously you cannot say you specialize in a practice area if it turns out you really don't. You don't have much experience at all in that practice area. Well, then don't say that. But I think that for most lawyers who practice in the appellate arena, if you really are experienced with appeals, I think it's now fair game to say that you specialize.
Of course, we would refer lawyers to the rules themselves to make their own interpretations about what they can and can't say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And even on the one I just mentioned, it's not quite as explicit as what I said. So there's still room for interpretation. But I think overall, you're going to be OK now, as long as the key is you just don't be false or misleading.
Right. And that is a thread.
I just thought of one more change that I have to mention because it's just such a fun one. Tell clients that you can use threats of violence to accomplish their objectives. I don't know where that came from, like what case prompted that or something, but it just seemed like that was such a Texas thing to have in the rules.
Yeah, that very much is. Huh. I'm interested if anyone's listening and knows the story, send it to us privately because I'm curious too.
Same. That again evokes thoughts about the old West to me, but wow. You know, there was one other thing that I noticed in the rules, Zach, that I thought was a significant change that had more to do with solicitation than advertising. And that is that apparently now we can actually solicit someone who, with a specific legal problem, if the person is someone who is known by the lawyer to be an experienced user of the type of legal services involved for business matters, which sort of segues into your practice area too, that's quite a change. I mean, I guess we as lawyers now, if we know that there's a specific legal issue that a company is facing, it's fair game to actually send them solicitation notices without necessarily getting pre-approval from the state bar.
Yeah, I think there's a whole list of exemptions from the restriction on person-to-person solicitation. So those are definitely worth looking at. I know in the past, there were procedures. I mean, you could do written solicitations, but you had to jump through a lot of hoops to do that. So it may be simpler and easier to do that now. And that could certainly be relevant in appellate practice where, you know, you see a big verdict against a big company, you might want to call them up and say, hey, just curious about this, you know, or, you know, I do appeals of this kind of case all the time, you know, so that something like that might be fair game. Yeah. Again, take a close look at the rule to make sure that you fall under whatever exemption you're going to rely on.
Well, that's very informational and informative because we all need to be concerned about
absolutely
these kinds of issues. What I'm curious about, and maybe you've already explained it, is you just started your own firm after these changes were made. Why not the trade secret law firm or the covenant not to compete law firm? And you went with the classic Zach Wolf law firm.
Right, right. I'm glad you asked that. I just encountered this issue. So I'm working on a new logo for the firm. And one of my lawyer friends didn't like my prospective logos because they didn't indicate anything about my practice area. And I see the point, and I can see how for some firms you might want your firm name or your trademark or logo to communicate to people your practice area. I don't feel like that. I guess, number one, my practice area could change, mm-hmm. right? And I want to develop recognition and goodwill for my name apart from any particular practice area. I'll use other means to let people know what my practice area is. You know, so that's kind of my thinking, is that I want the name to be the thing that gets the attention. And then, you know, I've got lots of other ways, like the blog and the YouTube channel and Twitter, to let people know about what kind of work I do.
So just to be clear for people listening, Zach doesn't actually do the law of wolves. It's just Zach Wolf Law.
That's right.
It's not a trade name.
Right. It's not an area of law confined to Zach Wolf. That would be interesting, but no.
Well, Zach, this is all great information. Thank you for taking the time. As we kind of reach the end of our time here, we always like to ask our guests for a tip or war story. You've given plenty of tips, but if you have another one or if you have a war story you'd like to tell, we'd love to hear it.
Well, and I almost forgot, do we have a sponsor today? I was going to talk about, I was just on Westlaw Edge this morning looking at this issue. It's a great product, but
Thompson Reuters actually is a sponsor and is in part actually a sponsor of all of our episodes. But, you know, if it's constructive criticism that could be taken the right way, I would say go ahead. And if not, we'll just edit it out.
Yeah. Well, in all seriousness, I love Westlaw. I use it all the time. But no, here's a thing I'll leave people with. Considering, you know, this is the Texas Appellate Law podcast and we have appellate law listeners, I would just go back to what I said about having a successful solo practice and specialization. The specialization, I think, is really the thing that has made my solo practice more successful this second time. And I would say if you're an appellate lawyer trying to build your book of business, think about whether there's some specialty within appellate that could work for you. Because, I mean, yeah, appellate, that's a lot narrower than just litigation, but still, there's a lot of appellate lawyers.
Absolutely. Right?
And really what your goal ought to be is you want people in your network, when they think appellate lawyer, you want to be number one or number two of the people who pop into their head. And if you're just appellate, you know, your chances of being one or two are lower than if it's like, I don't know, like appeals of, let's say it's mandamus appeals of, you know, discovery rulings. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be a, I'm from South Austin, so I say niche. I don't say niche. But that might be a niche that you could establish where, you know, when somebody thinks about, oh, appeals on discovery rulings. Oh, I know who does that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just one example. There's lots of things like that. That's what I would urge people to do. I mean, if you've already, if you're like a Todd Smith or Jody Sanders, and you've already, you're already at the top of the profession, maybe you don't need that. But if you're just starting out and you're building your name for yourself, think about how you can specialize, and that'll help you do that.
That's great. That's yeah, a great reminder to all of us, though. It really is.
I think so. And no promotional consideration was given for that last comment.
That was purely educational and information.
That's right.
Well, Zach, thanks again. This really has been great. We've enjoyed hearing from you, and we look forward to staying in touch.
Great. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.